Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast, where we delve deep into the gravity-based side of mountain biking. This week, the podcast is supported by Canyon Bikes and Lacquer. As a listener, you'll know that I'm always trying to make sure that the podcast is supported by great brands who are relevant to you. And this means that I've turned a number of companies down. So when I was approached by an insurance company, I was expecting them to go on the no thank you list. But I did some research and decided that I liked what I saw. For starters, their rating on smartmoneypeople.com is currently 4.99 out of 5 from 253 reviews, and you can't say that about many insurance companies. Lacquer has flipped outdated traditional insurance on its head with no more fixed upfront premiums. Instead, your monthly contributions are based on the collective's claims from that month. When you get a quote, they will tell you your likely monthly payment, and they will also give you a monthly cap, which will never be exceeded. If no one in the collective claims that month, and this has happened, then you don't pay anything. The savings are all yours. Lacquer only get paid when they resolve a claim, which is handled by experts and usually agreed within a day, with no depreciation or excess. So they're there, ready and waiting to help you get back out on the trails as quickly as possible, rather than try not to pay out like many traditional insurance models. They've also ditched annual contracts locking you in, so with Lacquer, if you want to leave, you can anytime. They even offer a health and recovery add-on, which will help you out should you have an accident and need support in getting back on the bike. Basically, Lacquer's collective cover is designed for mountain bikers, and I'm stoked to have them as a supporting partner of the podcast. It's super easy to get a quote, and as a Downtime listener, there's a £10 credit for new customers signing up today using the code DOWNTIME, all in capitals, one word. So head over to lacquer.co, yes that is .co and not .com, and Lacquer is spelled L-A-K-A, and check out what they can do for you. You can find all the links you need over in the show notes for this episode on downtimepodcast.com. I've been lucky enough to borrow the new Canyon Sender over the last couple of weeks, and I've been absolutely loving riding it. It's so confidence-inspiring and has enabled me to go bigger and faster than ever before. Unfortunately, I've now had to box it up and send it back, which was a very sad day. But if you want to get yourself a Canyon in your life, then they have kindly offered Downtime listeners free bike guard on all their gravity range globally until the end of August. So if you're interested in a Spectral, Strive, Torque or Sender, then you can save yourself a bit of money. All you need to do is to head to canyon.com and use the coupon code DOWNTIME2020. That's the word DOWNTIME, all in capitals, followed by the number 2020 with no space. All the terms and conditions for this offer can be found in the show notes for this episode over on downtimepodcast.com. You can support the podcast by grabbing yourself a t-shirt over at downtimepodcast.com/shop. There's four designs to choose from. They're all 100% organic, made using renewable energy and shipped without any single-use plastics. Don't forget to subscribe to the show for free so you get every episode as soon as it drops, and join my newsletter for a weekly dose of interesting bike-related stuff, competitions, products I've been enjoying, and more. You can do both those things at downtimepodcast.com/subscribe. All right, this week I'm joined by one of the youngest photographers on the World Cup circuit, Isaac Paddock. Isaac is the photographer for the YT Mob and also now works at YT looking after their social media. He's taken a different route to other photographers and has managed to create his perfect role within the industry. We sat down to chat about why he started bike photography and how he got from an average racer to being paid to be at the World Cups and travel the world following the sport he's passionate about. From photographing toilets to working alongside legends like Brooke McDonald and Aaron Gwynn, Isaac has never been shy of putting the work in so as he can follow his passion. So without further ado, here's Isaac Paddock. Isaac Paddock, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. How's it going?
I'm good, thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, tell everyone where we are.
So we're in Chorley in my house. On the edge of the Pennine Moors. Great place for riding.
Yeah.
And so, pretty central to everywhere in the UK, really.
Yeah. Rivington is your local, yeah?
Yeah. My local, Elliot Heap's local, Martha Gill. I mean, Sam Hill's even been here riding.
It's, has he?
It's brilliant.
Did you get to ride with him when he was here?
No.
Or not?
Honestly, it's the smallest hill in the world. But it's good fun. Good crew always out shredding.
Nice. That's pretty cool. I didn't know Sam had been here.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Well, let's go back to the early days then for you. And rather than starting off with riding, let's start off with photography. How did you get into that side of things?
Well, probably a pretty standard media entry, I'd say. I was pretty terrible at racing. And obviously, like most other people, wanted to still be at the races and kind of find my purpose. And that was through taking pictures, so...
But had you been like, you didn't just like photography was an interest before then, was it? Or did you literally go, hang on a minute, I'm crap at riding, I'm going to be a photographer?
I'd say it was probably that. And then I thought, well, how can I better myself? And then went on to study photography at college.
Okay, fair play.
So yeah, that was real interesting. Didn't really learn too much in terms of what we do today in mountain bike photography, but
yeah,
kind of the principle behind it and like just learning the basics really.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was good.
Yeah. So riding came first for you then?
Yeah, definitely came first, and I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for the riding.
Yeah. What age were you when you got into that?
Probably 12. Standard entry with my parents, always riding, and
yeah,
just loved two wheels and yeah.
And was it always mountain biking then, or was there other types of riding when you were a kid?
Yeah, always mountain biking, and now it's kind of opened up and do a lot more disciplines. Like I love road biking, love gravel biking, just any sort of two wheels. It's good to get out and just freedom, innit?
Yeah. And what sort of racing were you doing then when you were younger?
Oh, I tried downhill racing pretty terribly, and but I'm glad to still be here.
Yeah. What series were you doing then? Were you doing like Pierce and stuff or nationals? No,
just kind of small regional races. And I'm probably a mid-pack warrior, but I think I'm definitely better at taking pictures.
Yeah, fair play. So you knew from quite a young age then that you were, I guess, felt strongly enough about mountain biking as a sport that you wanted to work within it, but that riding wasn't the way for you to get there.
Yeah, I'd say so, and I'm pretty glad I made that call early on, and it's just awesome to still be in the industry and kind of have a place where I can contribute my best skills to it.
Yeah. So what age would you have been when you decided that that was the way you wanted to go then?
I was probably in the last year of school, so 15. And I was kind of weighing up whether to do engineering and follow my dad's footsteps or to go the complete opposite direction and against all of my family, do a more art approach and take photography.
Yeah.
And that's the way I went.
Was it a hard decision to make then?
Oh, it was a real hard decision because there's obviously not many jobs and I didn't want to be a wedding photographer. So yeah, I took a big gamble, I think.
Yeah.
And it's slowly paying off.
And it was specifically, that gamble was for mountain bike photography. It wasn't just photography excited you. You wanted to be in the sport.
Yeah, definitely. I don't think I could do any sort of generic landscape, wedding photography, none of that.
Yeah.
It really interests me.
Fair play. So did you have a decent camera at this point, or were you literally starting from scratch?
Literally starting from scratch. I think I had some savings that my parents had kindly saved up over the years from Christmases and birthdays, and they told me it was for my first car, and spent it all on a camera.
Did you? What did you get?
Back in the day, it was a Canon 550D.
Okay.
A nice kit lens, and I actually upgraded the package from Jessup's to get me an extra kit lens,
nice,
which was a zoom, and it was a 75 to 300, and did quite a lot with that.
Yeah.
Probably £600-700 camera.
And that was the camera you started college with and started your mountain bike photography career with?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then from then just slowly upgraded.
Yeah. So you're starting college, you're stopping racing a bit and trying to get into the world of mountain bike photography, which I'm sure people will be aware is a pretty crowded world, certainly now. I'm not sure a few years ago if it was quite as crowded, but how did you go about making your way into the industry?
It was definitely a tough one, and it's not getting any easier. And I kind of looked at all my options of trying to get in and like message people on how to get in. And I just ended up doing internship with MBR magazine down in London for 2 weeks. I self-funded it, probably spent a lot of money as well, again. And yeah, that was really good. Got me a good insight into the industry, working alongside some good guys in MBR. And that kind of got me a foot in the door. And it kind of rolled from there pretty smoothly. I'm really fortunate to have had that opportunity, but I did create it for myself. Like, no one else in college at that time was pursuing kind of their own opportunities like that, and it wasn't something college told us we could do it.
Yeah,
I just did it off my own back and did it in a college holiday off my own money.
Fair play. So you got yourself down to London. Put yourself up for a couple of weeks and got stuck in.
Yeah, exactly. Age 16 in the big smoke. probably not getting served alcohol.
Nice.
Probably a terrible time.
What kind of stuff did you do then on that first 2 weeks?
So I did a lot in the studio for MBR, studio photography, which I'm actually really passionate about. And then we did a lot of trail stuff and helping write features, stuff like that. It was good.
Yeah, eye-opening.
Eye-opening for sure. Didn't know you had to write features if you was a photographer.
And did you know then that you'd made the right choice? That was definitely what you wanted to be doing.
I think about halfway through that week, I was like, yeah, this is pretty awesome.
Yeah.
All working alongside all the newest equipment and bikes, I was just in my element.
Cool. So where do you go from there then?
So from there, they asked me to go to Fort William World Cup. And I was like, wow, this is a 6-hour drive from my house. I didn't drive at the time. So how am I going to get there? I was just like, yeah, I'll do it. I'll find my way somehow. Yeah. And I ended up catching the train. I think it took maybe 11 hours. It was a long one. But I'm really glad I did that. And at the time, just before going to Fort William World Cup, I was like, right, I should probably use this as an opportunity to kind of network and see what other work's out there, because I was coming to the end of my college studies at this time, so kind of looking for a job.
Yeah.
So I fired out many, many emails and probably got two responses, and one of them was from Martin Whiteley.
Okay.
And I was pretty surprised that I got a response. Actually got I've still got the letter, the email framed in my office.
Nice.
So he responded and said, just like, come and introduce yourself at the World Cup.
So what do you say in the email? What were you like asking for, I suppose?
I was just asking, like, is there any way I can assist the team? Like, kind of another internship. Like, exactly what I did for MBR, but for a World Cup team. And I was probably poaching someone's job at this point. But, yeah, that's all I want. I just wanted some experience to work alongside the best, to get the best athletes in front of my lens and have that opportunity.
And were you sending, like, was it just an email, or were you sending some examples of your work? Did you have much of a portfolio at that time?
I probably had a really bad website at this point, but I did have a website. It had a lot of work on. And yeah, I definitely sent a portfolio of some sort.
Yeah.
And just kind of what I could offer to the team. And that's it.
Cool. And Martin got back.
And I was real nervous, pretty nervous about most things in life. And I just remember going up to the Trekwell Racing pits. I'm probably age 16 at this point and probably look about age 10. And introduce myself to one of the legends of the sport. And it went really well. And he just said, like, there's no openings, but keep in touch. Yeah. And we love your work.
Nice.
So I was like, fair enough. Like, what a guy for responding to my email, because obviously no one else did, but I didn't expect that anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was really good.
Yeah. And how was the Fort William World Cup weekend? Like, was that your first time at a World Cup?
Yeah, first time at a World Cup. It was absolute madness. It was the year... It was like a 5 a.m. start because the weather was so bad.
Yeah.
And I was just like, this is the sickest thing ever. Like, I couldn't believe it. It was just awesome. The whole vibe, everyone was so friendly, all the media guys, and just Fort William World Cup's just special in itself because of the crowd, and the pits just feels like it's, you just have to go there to feel that.
It's a buzz. Yeah. And so you were completely on your own. You didn't go with anyone you knew on that trip.
Yeah, I actually went with a friend I went to college with, but he wasn't a photographer.
Yeah.
And we just kind of made a little holiday, I guess, of it, and turned out to be a very good holiday.
Yeah, and you shot a load of stuff for MBR then while you were there.
Yeah, we just shot like a small web gallery, and it was... can't really say much more. It was just a good job.
Yeah. And where do we go from there then? You've got like semi foot in the door with Martin at YT. You've done this work for MBR.
So at this point we're probably June 2015, and I'm working part time in retail to fund going to races and like build up my portfolio. I was working for Chain Reaction Nuke Proof at the Nationals.
How did you get that then?
That was just through email in Pagey, and the same kind of deal. He responded, and luckily there was an opening there. So that was good. And I was looking for something a bit more full-time, and I wasn't sure that mountain bike photography was the way. Because I was struggling to get more than just weekend work at races, just covering a bit more than the expenses.
Yeah.
So I was really struggling. And then I ended up taking a job doing product photography for a bathroom company in Manchester.
Nice.
So I was stoked to get my first salary and actually take pictures for a living.
Yeah.
It felt real good. And then still... go to the races at the weekend, but then I was working 7 days a week. But I guess at the age of 17, it's pretty normal to do that. So
yeah,
kind of did that for till this end of 2015, and then Martin got in touch again. Yeah, Martin got in touch and said, we need someone to shoot a Trek World Racing team camp. And I was like, holy shit. Like, this is not me. I can't do this.
Right.
With Brooke McDonald and George Brannigan and Greg Williamson. And then I ended up going to Malaga. It was probably my first time flying without my parents.
Really? Fair play.
Super nervous.
Yeah.
And rented a load of camera equipment, spent more renting camera equipment than I did getting on the job. But I was just stoked for the opportunity, like I always am. And that was just had the time of my life, meeting everyone, meeting my idols and getting to work with them. And it was just a super relaxed atmosphere. Like, didn't feel like you was working with Brooke McDonald or George Brannigan or Martin Whiteley as well. Like, just, it felt normal to be there. Felt like I was in the right place.
Yeah. Cool. And that, some of that comes down to those guys as well being just genuinely good humans, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's real good working with them. They make it super easy and just know it's just part of the mountain bike vibe, I guess.
And were you worried about your output from that? Because there's a fair bit of pressure, I guess.
I was super super nervous about the output and what I had to do. And this was like the biggest shoot of my life, and I had 4 days to capture all these assets that Martin had sent me.
Yeah.
And Trek wanted all these pictures for advertising, and then there needed to be pictures on the side of a van. I was like, I've never done anything like this. I've kind of blagged my way to this shoot.
Yeah.
But I'm here now, so I've got to do it.
Yeah. The imposter syndrome kicks in, doesn't
it? Yeah.
Fair play. But it all went well, I guess.
Yeah, it went really well. Like, it was one of the best shoots I've ever been on, just because didn't expect it to be like that. It was just super easy working with the athletes, and you can't ask for more than that. Like, when they're super hungry to get the shot and work hard,
yeah,
then it just makes our job as a photographer much easier.
Nice. So Martin was happy with your work?
Yeah, Martin was, I think, pretty happy, and even the guys from marketing at Trek was happy. So then if the riders are happy and then the client's happy, then you can't really say fairer than that.
All good. And so did that then lead on to further work with Martin?
It went quiet after that, because at the time, Matt Delorme was the photographer for Trek World Racing.
Okay.
And so I didn't expect anything, because obviously I had Matt, and we just kept in touch over email if there was anything he needed from Nationals or whatever. But yeah, it went quiet, and I was just milling away at the bathroom company, still shooting toilets, having a good time. And then it was probably, yeah, the end of 2015 when Trek World Racing finished. Martin got back in touch and said he's setting up a new program, and I was like, okay. And then we was on the phone for probably an hour while I was driving home from Manchester, from the day job, and he offered me the job and didn't say anything about the sponsors, the riders, nothing.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, sweet, I'll take it. Didn't even know what the salary was or anything until he sent me an email a few days later, and I was like, holy shit, like, get paid this much to do this. And then I was like, sweet, quitting the day job for sure.
Awesome. And at what point did you find out, like, about the program and who was riding? And
it was probably the middle of I signed my contract probably the first week of January.
Uh-huh.
And probably the first week of February, or maybe a little bit sooner,
yeah,
I found out about the sponsors, the riders, and I was like blown away. I was more nervous than ever at this point. Like, how can I shoot with this guy, Aaron Gwynn? Yeah, I couldn't be more stoked at this point.
Yeah, that's amazing. What was your first experience with the team then in that guise?
So we went to team camp in Granada, where Martin lives,
yeah,
and shot a bunch of pictures with Aaron and Angel and the whole team and Bike Build. And that was super cool. Like, just working with one of the legends of the sport. Yeah, I'm kind of speechless now talking about it, trying to think about it.
Yeah, but how do you kind of deal with those situations then, where you're suddenly in front of your idols, or, you know, people you've looked up to for a long time, and you've got to kind of work alongside them? How do you approach that? It's very easy to be a fanboy, right?
Yeah, I think it is, but I think I've had it, like, from working with these guys for quite a while now. I think back in 2016, I was probably a little bit fanboy or nervous around the guys and didn't kind of know what to say. But now they know me, I know them, and yeah, it's good. It just feels like we're good friends, and that kind of works when you're shooting. It just makes everything super relaxed, and everyone knows what to do.
Yeah. And you've been with the YT mob ever since. So that's 4 years.
Yeah. This is my fifth year now. So I've been with the mob since the start and yeah, couldn't be happier. It's like a second home to me.
Yeah. And what's it like traveling with the team then? Cause you are all right. You're there as a photographer, but you're a lot more than that really.
Yeah, I guess so. It's good. Like my position is a rarity in the mountain bike community that not many other photographers are like kind of staff on the team.
Yeah.
But it's really good to travel with all these guys and have fun at the races. And we are like a second family to each other, and just everywhere we go riding and drinking beers, you can't ask for more. It just makes being on the road like half of the year a lot more easy.
Yeah. And what's it like? Have you had the opportunity to get out for a ride with people like Nico and Angel and Aaron?
Yeah. So I ride a lot with Angel and did a lot with Nico when he was on the team. Yeah, it's nice when they're riding, like they take it easy so we can keep up. But yeah, it's good.
So you're at 100% and they're like, oh, just cruising, yeah?
I'm 150% there at like 10.
Have you learnt much from riding with guys like that then?
Not really, because I'm trying to catch my breath most of the time. But no, I don't really like to bother them about riding. Like, I just rather just chill, and it's normally the end of a long day or whatever. We're just cruising. Nice, yeah. Spin at the end of the day. You can't beat it, can you?
Yeah, definitely. So what, yeah, talk us through a World Cup weekend from your perspective then. What does it involve from kind of the day you arrive to the day you leave?
Well, the day I arrive, we get there, set up the pits, which is pretty unusual from a photographer, but...
Yeah, so you're helping build the pits.
Yeah, I like it. Like, it feels like we are a team when everyone pitches in. Even sometimes the riders are helping. Yeah, it is like a family at that point. And then we probably go in on track walk or whatever, just snapping away. I actually hate track walk.
Why is that?
Just, you can't make it look any different. Like, there is no way to make track walk look exciting, but... it is what it is. It gives you a good time to scope the track and see the changes.
So what are you looking at from a photographer's perspective? Because I guess it's your first time seeing the track that year, right?
Yeah. And obviously with the World Cups, we normally see the tracks every year because mm-hmm. the venue doesn't change that much.
Yeah.
But just try and create something different from the last year. Like if you shot a spot last year, try and find something new around the same place, because normally you know the riding's good.
Yeah.
But it's good to know a few different locations and pick out them on track walk, and then you can go to them efficiently on practice day or finals day or whenever.
Yeah. What are you looking for then when you're looking for a spot? What makes a good spot?
Well, from a photography perspective, like obviously we have requirements for our sponsors and to feature them. And so we need a wide variety of shots, like from side on to three quarters to head on. So it's kind of like ticking off a few different angles that make that work. And just trying to find like nice turns, nice compressions, big jumps. And then also on track walk, it gives you a good chance to ask the riders where they think they look good.
Okay.
Because it's always good to work with them like that and see what they want to be pictured on.
Yeah.
And that's, I like doing that a lot.
Yeah, fair play. So you've gone through track walk and then I guess, practice day is when it starts getting a bit more hectic for you, right?
Yeah, practice day is normally pretty chill in the pits and everyone's getting prepared, good time to get lifestyle shots and any additional shots you need from sponsor requests or whatever.
Yeah.
And then head up on the track and start picking your way down. And a lot of the photographers kind of stay in bunches or like together, because we're all good friends at the end of the day, so it's like hanging out with your friends. But I like to mix it up a little bit different and kind of shoot different angles at different times.
Yeah, try and get something a little bit original, a bit different.
Yeah, it is really hard because a lot, like, these venues have been shot 10 times. So to try and get something original is a challenge.
Yeah.
But that's what the job is. And
it's 10 times by a lot of talented photographers, yeah, as well. It's not just a bunch of amateurs turning up, is it? It's
exactly.
People know what they're doing.
We thrive off each other and kind of buzz and try and create something different.
Yeah. Is there a bit of a sort of competitive spirit within the photography group to get that like original shot?
Totally. And yeah, it's made harder with the more clients you have, I guess.
Yeah. So does that makes your life a bit easier than only having to shoot YT riders?
A little bit easier, but like when we had going on the team and you still have to get really solid shots. So if you mess one up, that's one less creative chance you get.
Yeah, because you don't see them many times come past the lens, right, in a race weekend.
Probably four times in practice, maybe less if you're shooting Gwyn, and then qualifying and race. But, yeah, not many times. So if you mess up or your camera messes up, you really are up shit's creek.
And are you trying to shoot, like you see Sven sometimes with like three different cameras in his hands or whatever, trying to shoot multiple angles of the same rider going past him. Do you work like that, or do you tend to use one camera and try and get that one shot that you're after?
I actually just like to do one. Okay. Yeah, I like to perfect one. Then I think if I tried to do two, I'd get two mediocre shots.
Okay.
Rather than one that I'm really happy with.
Yeah. What equipment do you take on the hill with you then? Does it vary based on the venue?
It doesn't really vary too much. Normally take two Canon 1DXs, 1DX Mark II, and then a 70 to 200, 24 to 70, and then a fisheye.
Yeah.
But try and keep it as light as possible, like your bag, just so the long days, you need to keep some room for food and beer.
Important stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But
when you're hiking up and down, you want something as lightweight as possible.
Yeah, so keep it pretty simple. Yeah. I guess that covers all the bases, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So practice, it gives you the opportunity to get all those shots that you need. Does your objective change when it comes to race day? Like, how important are those race day photos, and will they be different in the way you're looking to create them?
Well, race day is a hard one because it depends on who you're shooting, but for example, if you're shooting Gwyn, you know there's a big chance he's going to win.
Yeah.
And you need to capture that finish line, atmosphere, and then have the chance to get the moments after, like the facial expressions. Just capture the emotion,
yeah,
of winning a World Cup and what it means. So that's really one of the important things.
Okay. And that varies depending on rider, I guess. So if you've got, let's say you've got three riders in a team, one of them's highly likely to win, maybe one of them's very unlikely to win. Like, how do you decide where you're going to be on the hill? I suppose their qualifying position separates them and that helps you a bit, but
yeah, you've definitely got some time between your riders, unless you've got a lot of them with a high chance of winning.
Yeah.
But I think if your rider's not going to win, then an action shot is really more beneficial from a sponsor perspective.
Yeah.
Because realistically, no one's going to print a 20th place finish
coming
into the finish line.
Yeah.
So, but that's like common sense. So just go up a bit further up the track. There's normally some good turns or whatever close to the finish line, and then just head on down when you need to, really.
Yeah. So you're on the hill and you've only got, let's say there's three riders on the team, you've only got three riders to shoot. It gives you a lot of other riders coming past. Do they get ignored? Like, how do you approach your hobby of photography, I suppose, at that point? Like, do you still take shots?
For me, I'm probably one of the only guys who's not shooting more than one client, I guess. So every other rider other than my two or three is just taking up memory card space. But it's definitely beneficial to, like, know where your riders are going to be, know the position, know the light, know, you get your composition right. So I kind of use a few riders to do that.
Okay.
And then I'll probably sit there for a while and have a little daydream or nap or whatever.
Get the beer and the food out.
Yeah. But normally I'm working with alongside Brock. He's been our video guy for the past 5 years with me.
Yeah.
So we're normally pretty close together on the hill and just chatting while we're waiting for riders, I guess.
Sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah.
Cool. So like you said, you're one of the few, if maybe the only, who shoots for one client at a World Cup. How have you been able to make that work when other photographers are having to shoot for a portfolio of clients?
I guess I'm just a not really a greedy guy. I'm living in Brexit. It's cheap. I do other stuff for the team as well. Like, I guess I'm a content manager and deal with the sponsors from a PR perspective as well.
Okay.
So my role is not only to create the content, but to do the next steps as well.
Yeah.
So I get paid a little bit more for that. And in turn means I don't have to shoot for 10 clients. Yeah. And that's the way I like it.
Yeah. And alongside that, you've picked up other work with YT along the way, yeah?
Yeah, I've been fortunate enough to kind of work alongside YT for the whole duration, but more recently gone into the social media department. Uh-huh. And kind of run the social media channels with my good friend Jan Philip. And yeah, together we do all the social media and video concepts, photo concepts for YT.
Okay, so that's not just the mob, that's YT.
Yeah.
The entire company.
Rampage, Crankworks, most of that stuff's gone through our emails several times.
And is that something like you've just got into that? You haven't studied it, like you've just kind of used your own time to try and work out how social media works, what's good, what's bad? And
yeah, exactly. I really thrive off new challenges, and not so much in the photography world, but just like the whole technology and what you can do with pictures and the whole process of from creating a picture to the end result. Mm-hmm. So obviously in this day and age, social media is a huge part of it. And I've just enjoyed every second of being able to work with YT and kind of improve their strategy and get some more likes and followers, I guess.
But how much detail does that go into? Because for most people, Instagram is just posting a picture, maybe some half-assed caption and some hashtags and away you go. But I'm guessing that a brand like YT, there's a lot more thought that goes into it.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot more thought. Like, I mean, we have certain products we have to push, and there's messages behind the brand that we want to tell, and stories as well. So kind of making sure all those things align, as well as keeping like relevant races and news and other stuff that goes on, and get that on the channel as well.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things from everywhere that you need to put on the channel and kind of schedule it in a nice way that grows the channel.
Yeah. How much of that is kind of data driven then? How much are you looking at the results of things you've done in the past and using that to inform what you do in the future?
Not too much, because I guess we're kind of driven by the algorithm now. So making sure we're utilizing all the new trends that Instagram and Facebook are implementing to kind of get our content onto new feeds. Mm-hmm. And that's mainly the way we go instead of looking at data from the past.
Yeah. Do you get any help from brands like Facebook and Instagram with what they're doing to the algorithm, or do you have to work that out?
We get a little bit of help, but really not too much. It's just a lot of research on our parts and kind of maybe an interpretation to some point of how things are going, and that's kind of how we figure it out.
Yeah. And is it just the YT channel, or do you help some of your athletes with that as well?
I'm there to help the athletes as well, but I never post for them. But if they want some advice on how to grow the channel or what content they should post, for sure I can help them with that.
Yeah. Fair play. I want to pick your brains a little bit on the social media side of things, because I think it's pretty challenging for athletes, and certainly athletes that are kind of up and coming at the minute, in that, you know, it used to be if you were getting good race results, you'd get sponsored, and that was kind of how it worked. And now there seems to be almost two routes. There's, you can get good race results and you'll probably pick up a social media following anyway as a result, and you'll get sponsored, or you can be a really good kind of social media athlete and have a really strong presence there, and that makes you valuable to a brand. Do you think, where do you think athletes should be focusing their time? And do you think like that social media element is perhaps taking away some of the talent pool from racing, or will it in the future? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think, honestly, the algorithm's making it harder now. So I think those who are already there with the social media are going to see, obviously, a natural growth. But for new people coming in, it's going to be really difficult to kind of create a career around social media, I feel. And I predict that we're going to see a bit of a full circle and go back to race results. I think that is a real good metric to kind of use in mountain biking, and we should be using a bit more often than just how many followers someone's got.
Yeah. How far away do you think we are from that full circle? Because it feels like we're still climbing to a peak of the value of some of these athletes through social media.
Yeah, we are definitely a few more years off what I think is going to happen. I mean, it might not happen. just my interpretation, but a few more years and then we'll see race results being the number one for all brands.
Yeah. And do you think that's because social media will not disappear, but will kind of start to die off a little bit in its popularity, or what do you think will drive that?
I definitely think that, but like I said, it's really hard for new people to get into social media as like a social media athlete because of the algorithm. So we're going to see people dropping off, and
because it's harder to grow an account now.
So new people, it's not as easy to get in, and in turn, there's going to be less athletes available, I guess.
Yeah. So for younger riders then that are kind of up and coming and wondering where to focus their efforts, your recommendation would be to get training and get racing and focus on that side of things rather than worrying about their social media numbers? Or
I would definitely say that just focus on what you're passionate about. If your passion is creating content from day one, then that's fair enough, and we need that in the world.
Yeah.
But if you want to be a racer or just a paid athlete, then probably go chase some race results.
Yeah, fair comment. All right, good stuff. Let's talk a little bit about some of the other stuff you've been up to recently. Last year, the team was a bit different, right? You went from three riders to just Angel on the team. Angel was injured. Must have been a bit strange coming from that, like all the, you know, all singing, all dancing in 2018, and then 2019 was just kind of flat for you guys, I guess.
Yeah, it was kind of tough when going from obviously winning every weekend and winning from the start of my, I guess, career in 2016, we was winning every weekend with Gwyn.
Yeah.
And we was on a proper good streak. Everyone was buzzing. And then after those 3 years, we only had Angel on the team, and it was kind of like, wow, it was tough. But it was good to kind of have a different approach and no racing. And we went finding new talent around the world. And
yeah,
that was honestly one of my favorite years, more so than the racing.
Okay.
Like just going to all these mad places that you would never go to and watch kids that you would never see.
Yeah. And you found some pretty fast people.
Yeah, we found a lot of fast people, met a lot of nice people, and experienced a lot of different cultures along the way. But yeah, we found some fast people, and they came to Mob HQ for the finals camp, and two of them are now on the YT Mob,
yeah,
as professional riders.
And you had a like a team camp at the start of this year before all the lockdown really kicked off. First time, I guess, for all of that lot to be together, because you've got Angel and Dave Trummer, and then
Guy Johnson and Ocean O'Callaghan.
Yeah, so they're the two juniors that you found on the on the talent tour.
So yeah, we had a team camp kind of as Corona was kicking off, so it was pretty mad, and everyone was preoccupied. but yeah, it was fun to kind of get together as the new YT Mob and see everyone riding and just chilling together. It was really good.
Yeah, how did it feel? The team kind of bonding together?
Yeah, it was like being a family again. There was more of us, more staff, more riders, and just like good times were back. And yeah, can't wait to get to some races with all the boys.
Yeah, should be good if we get there.
Hopefully.
For sure. So you do a very good job of what you do, clearly. And have you had offers from other teams along the way? Like, and if so, what's kind of kept you with the Mob?
I actually haven't had any offers off other teams or companies, but partially that's probably my fault for not updating my portfolio, not using Instagram. And I'm honestly really happy where I am. Like, I couldn't be happier. It doesn't feel like work every day of the week.
That's a pretty good place to be.
Yeah.
And most of the time you're working from home, I guess, when you're not away with the team.
Yeah. When I'm not away, I work from home full time, and maybe a few office visits a year, but nothing behind the desk every day.
Yeah. Nice. Sounds good to me. So if people listening to this kind of interested in getting into the photography side of things with mountain biking, let's talk about gear first. Like, what would be the equivalent of the 550D with a couple of kit lenses now? Like, what would you recommend people go and get? Because the camera kit has come on a long way, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you're starting out, it really all depends on your budget, but you don't need much. Like when I started, I probably spent best part of £1,000, and that will get you a long way in terms of creating a good portfolio. And then if you do pick up some shoots and you need to get equipment, just hire it until you can afford it.
Yeah. What would you recommend then? So if, let's say we had £1,000 to get together a little beginner kit for mountain bike photography, let's say we're going to go shoot World Cups, what would you spend that money on?
I would definitely buy one body and two lenses, just a zoom lens and then a telephoto zoom lens, and then just like a normal 24-70 zoom.
Mm-hmm. So telephoto is like a long up to 200-300.
So 70-200, and then a 24-70, that'll cover most of your bases.
Yeah. And what body would you go for?
Whatever is around the £300 or £400 mark, and
right, then okay,
you got a bit more money to spend on the glass.
Okay, and you recommend that's the area to really be looking to try and spend a bit on.
Yeah, definitely spend more on the glass. Like my body I've been using is a 1DX for most of my career. That's made in maybe 2010 or something. So okay. It doesn't really matter too much about the body, but more about the lenses.
Yeah, that's where the quality of the shots comes from. Well, obviously a lot of skill as well, but you need good quality lenses.
Yeah. And just reliable equipment as well.
Yeah.
Don't get something that's going to die halfway through your shoot.
Okay. So you'd almost split that sort of £1,000 into three equal pots for one for a lens, one for the other lens, and one for the body.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, fair play. And then once they've got that and they're out shooting photos, like how would you recommend they approach getting involved in the mountain bike industry? Because I guess it can seem a little bit of a daunting task, right?
Yeah, it's very daunting, and it's a crowded market at the moment and probably will be for the foreseeable. But definitely reach out to as many people as you can and ask to help them. Like, say you want experience, and that's the way to go, I think.
Yeah.
It'll get you a long way if you're just genuine and happy to help.
And you think it's better off, you're better off contacting the teams than you are trying to contact the riders and like giving them shots and stuff, or?
Yeah, I definitely would go for the teams rather than the riders. You're more likely to get a response, I guess.
Yeah.
And the teams are, like, you can find the contacts readily available on the internet, so it's not like you're messaging someone on Instagram, they're never going to see it.
Yeah, fair play. And then if you do get your foot in the door, like, words of advice on how to make sure they want you back, I suppose. Like, what have you done that's enabled you to always get that next thing, do you think?
Just always be yourself at the first part, but be reliable and professional and do your job for the most part. But honestly, just reliability is a big thing. Like, if you've not got good enough equipment to get you the right shots or get you through the weekend without breaking stuff, then you're not going to be back.
Yeah. And so, what do you do as far as like backup and that side of things to kind of, to make sure that you're not going to lose shots? Because memory cards can...
I mean, just invest in the best equipment you can afford. But like every year, most photographers on the circuit probably spend £1,000 or euros on hard drives just to have several backups.
Right, okay.
So it's costly, but in the long run, it's something you need to do and it's part of the job.
Yeah. All right, good advice. A couple of quick questions. You've been to a lot of places, especially with the tour last year. Where's your favourite place you've ever ridden and why?
Favourite place I've ridden? Whoa. I don't get to ride that much, actually. That's one of the common misconceptions about mountain bike photography. But favourite place to ride? Probably Finale Lagoa.
Okay.
It's close, it's cheap, and the trails are all time. Like, just amazing, even in winter.
Yeah.
It's just nice to go there and get a bit of winter sun.
And you finish at the beach.
Exactly. Good, cheap coffee, cheap beer.
Great pizza.
Can't ask for anything more.
What's not to love? And then what's the best place you've shot? And is it different?
Yeah, for sure it's different. And I think I'm going to have to say Japan.
Okay.
Not so much the photography side, but it's just mind-blowing, the culture, everything that's going on around you. It's just contributing to that. For me, it goes into the picture. Like, it's hard to convey, and I guess that's a bad thing for me. But it's hard to convey through a picture because there's just so much. You need to go there to experience it, like all the mad sounds and the mad lights, and you can't read anything. You can't even order. You can't order food. It's just mad.
Yeah.
And definitely you should go there if you're listening to this.
Excellent. It's on the list for sure. Favorite rider to shoot and why?
Ooh. Gwyn. I'm going to have to say Gwyn. He was a blast to work with. Just super easy, professional, knew your vision and worked with you to get it. So that's it.
Yeah. So that's what makes a good rider when you're shooting them, then, someone that understands what you're trying to get out of it, or?
Yeah. And also someone who's like throwing their ideas into the mix on how to do things. And like, I'm not the best rider, so maybe I don't know the best angle, but I know how to shoot that angle.
Right.
So if they can help me with that bit, then I can do my bit properly.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's good to have someone who's like invested in the project to work alongside.
Cool. Where do you think we'll see technology going with mountain bike photography? Because you already see some photographers throwing up drones and getting some aerial shots. And do you think we'll see much progression in that? Or do you think it'll still be predominantly standard camera like we're all used to?
I think it's really reached its peak. Technology as a whole has kind of flattened out in the last few years, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And like I said, most of the photographers are shooting on equipment from 2015, 2010, and it's still producing these bangers today. So can't really ask for more. It's more about the reliability.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something I was going to ask about, actually. Like, how do you look after your kit when you're out in all kinds of condition, riders flinging mud and dust at the lenses? Like, how do you look after all of your kit?
I mean, you can't really look after it too much, because you got to be ready to switch lenses, or you're working in the worst weather possible.
Yeah.
And that's just a factor that you've got to accept as a mountain bike photographer. But for sure, get it serviced every year, every 6 months, and replace lenses as often as you can, really.
So it basically just comes down to spending some money, I suppose.
Spending a lot of money. A lot of money.
Not a cheap one, is it?
No.
This photography side.
No.
Fair play. Right, well, we'll wrap up with our final four questions. First one of those: if our listeners had £150 to spend to improve their performance on a bike, do bike first, what would you recommend they spend it on?
I would definitely buy a digital pressure gauge.
Yeah.
A good set of tyres.
Yeah.
You probably got a little bit of money left over.
Depends what tyres you get.
Yeah, 50 quid each on the Maxxis tyres, 20 quid for the pressure gauge, 30 quid left. Get your mates a round of beers or something.
Nice. What tyres are you your go-to then?
For local riding, I'm go with the Assegai up front and Aggressor in the rear. Especially now, like, it's summer, it's pretty nice.
You're like the third person in the last month to recommend that tyre.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, it's good.
Can't ask for more out of a tyre. It's fast rolling and perfect.
Double down casing?
Not for me, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, just the normal casing.
Getting away with it.
Yeah.
Like it. And then same question, but photography based.
150 quid, not going to get you much.
No.
You can't really get much for 150 quid. It's bad news if you're spending 150 quid. Maybe a new bag or something.
Okay, you get a hard drive.
Maybe you'd be pushing it.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
If you want a slow one, you can get one.
All right. Second one of those questions: if you could wind back the clock and sit down with yourself age 16, what advice would you give him?
It's only a few years ago, but there's not that much I regret, honestly. Probably ride with some faster people, and then I could maybe be a better rider. But I'd still be a photographer for sure.
Fair play. Did you ever think when you were 16 you'd be doing what you're doing now?
No chance. And I love it every day.
Yeah.
Nice. Dream job.
Happy days. Third one: if you can have a coaching session with anyone, who would it be and what would you want to learn from them?
Oh. I'd probably go with my good friend Elliot Heap. I need to get some actual mountain bike coaching so I can ride my bike a little bit better.
Is there a particular element of his riding that you'd want to pick into?
Just riding in general, I'm not great, so I could do with learning how to manual, and I think that'd really help me ride better. For sure.
You've got that nice short rear end on your bike, it should be easy.
Yeah, I know. Maybe I just need to man up and start practicing down the street.
Nice. All right, final question. What do you do every day that you feel benefits you?
Definitely drink a coffee in the morning. Normally eat a pie most days as well.
that must be a local thing.
Yeah, local Chorley pie from Bowen's. Big up to Bowen's for that.
I can't believe they were shut when I went there.
Man, you missed out big time. You're going to have to come back.
Going to have to mail order some.
Yeah.
Cool. Nice one. Well, if people want to keep up with what you're up to, what's the best place for them to look?
Probably on Instagram, but I'm really terrible with my own social media. So
what's your social media?
Just Isaac Paddock.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm honestly terrible and you won't find much. I'm kind of just... like invisible.
All right, well, we'll put a link to that, and we'll put a link to the YT Mob so they can see some of your
Maybe YT Industries is the brand as well. Normally get a few shots in there every week.
Yeah, good stuff. All right, well, it's been super interesting chatting.
Yeah,
hopefully
thanks.
We get some racing going later this year, and we look forward to seeing more of your bangers from there.
Yeah, nice one, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Cool, cheers, man.
Cheers.
All right, that's it for this episode with Isaac. I hope you've enjoyed listening. A massive thanks to Lacquer for supporting this episode of the podcast. They've turned insurance on its head and created bike insurance that's simple, effective, and perfect for mountain bikers. Head over to lacquer.co. Yes, that's .co and not .com. Lacquer is spelled L-A-K-A. And check out what they can do for you. It's super easy to get a quote, and as a Downtime listener, you can get £10 credit by signing up as a new customer today using the discount code DOWNTIME. Also, don't forget that as a Downtime listener, you can get free Bike Guard globally on all Canyon Gravity bikes until the end of August by using the code DOWNTIME2020. That's DOWNTIME, all in capitals, followed by the number 2020 with no spaces. That offer is valid on the Spectral, Strive, Torque and Sender, so head to canyon.com and get involved. The terms and conditions for the offer, along with all the links you need, are in the show notes for this episode on downtimepodcast.com. If you fancy a new t-shirt, then head over to downtimepodcast.com/shop, where you can pick yourself up some new threads and help support the podcast at the same time. Keep on telling your riding friends about the podcast, keep sharing the episodes on your social media, and generally just being the awesome supporters of the show that you are. This podcast is for you, so it's always great to see and hear that you're enjoying it. All right, we've got another awesome episode coming up soon, but until then, get out and ride.